Hello, it's Jodine here, and I'm part of Gaimia Baptist Church, which is a faith community in southern Sydney. We're glad you can join us for this podcast as part of our May Mission Month experience. Today we'll be looking at human trafficking through an interview with Ruth Elliott, who is the CEO of Daughters of Cambodia. Ruth is a psychologist who's lived in Cambodia for 14 years, working with victims of sex trafficking. She started at Daughters of Cambodia in 2007 and has empowered over 750 girls to leave the sex industry and start a new life of freedom. We hope you enjoy this conversation and may God speak to you as you listen.
Good evening. Let me add my welcome to you. It is great to have Ruth with us. How many of you have been to Cambodia on one of our short-term trips and have actually been to to Daughters? Yeah, about a handful of you. If you haven't been, you've obviously heard us talk a little bit about Daughters of Cambodia, and so it's great to have you with us today. You flew in yesterday, and you leave on Tuesday, so it's a whirlwind trip, so thank you for spending a whole quarter of your time in Sydney with us. You have four children. Can you tell us about your kids?
Sure. So I have two older daughters in their early 20s who are in England. And I have two younger children, aged 10 and 12, who are in Cambodia. So this weekend, they're actually staying with a family from Sydney.
But in Cambodia.
They're in Cambodia.
Yes. Yeah, very good. So have you been able to chat to them today at all? You have? Great. So
I've been in the pool swimming today. Okay. It's hot there.
So a little bit of a Mother's Day for you. That's very nice. Do they celebrate Mother's Day in Cambodia as a day?
Not really.
Okay.
There are foreigners there that celebrate it, but Cambodians don't.
Okay. Now, you've been in Cambodia for 14 years. What do you love most about being in Cambodia?
Most of all, I love the people. They are just so tender-hearted and so beautiful. They have beautiful hearts. I have many, many Cambodian friends. And the girls I work with, I find surprisingly very, very soft-hearted. I had expected they would have pretty hard hearts and, you know, because they've had a lot of bad stuff happen to them, but they're very, very tender. So most of all, I love the people. I also love the weather, because it's always hot.
So are there any things you miss about the UK?
Mm-hmm. I used to miss the countryside a lot, because Cambodia, it does have countryside, but it's not the same as England. So I used to miss the rolling green hills. Now I've got so used to beautiful beaches in Cambodia that I really no longer miss the countryside in England. I like the beach.
So would you call yourself more Cambodian than English?
Probably would, yes.
Yeah? No, that's great. That's great. Now, if someone had found you at, I don't know, age 10 and said to you, Ruth, you're going to spend your life in Cambodia working with those who have been in sex trafficking, like, would you have believed any of that?
No. I actually would not have believed it even at the age of 20 if you told me that.
Yes. But it wasn't actually much later than 10 that you really actually began to feel that perhaps this was where God had called you to be. So can you talk a bit about, like, growing up and faith for you?
Yes. So as I was growing up and during my childhood, I had a lot of pain, a lot of painful experiences happened to me, and I was brokenhearted growing up. I grew up really with no sense that I was even a person. I had a lot of rejection in my life. And so by the age of 11, I was suicidal every day. I had no hope. And when I was 14, I met some young people my age, teenagers, who were really on fire for God. They were in this church that was really on fire, and I really wanted what they had. So I went to my room on my own and I said, God, if you can have a relationship with them, you can have a relationship with me. I want you to show me that you're real and I want you to speak to me. So,
can I just interrupt?
Yes.
Sorry. Would you have said that at that point that you had a really clear understanding of who Jesus was? Like, would you have called yourself a Christian when you prayed that prayer?
I was not a Christian yet. Yeah. I knew nothing about God. I just knew that I wanted what they had. They had a relationship with God, which I knew I needed. I had no hope in my life. and I wanted God. So I began to seek God, and I didn't really care how long it took. I was going to wait there until he showed himself to me and spoke to me. I wanted him to speak to me. So I just began to wait on God on my own and reading my Bible. I was 14, so I didn't really have any theological understanding. I was just reading the Bible and waiting, asking God to speak to me. And pretty soon he began to speak to me. And it wasn't really what I expected him to say. What he said to me was that he's put a call on my life, and that the call is to Asia. And the call is from Isaiah 61, verses 1 to 3, that verse that Russell read out earlier, to heal the brokenhearted and set captives free, and that it would be a Moses calling to lead people out of slavery and into freedom.
So we talk about that a little bit?
Yes.
I mean, because I think we would all kind of go, yeah, we have a relationship with God, and we know that God speaks to us, but that's a pretty heavy call for someone who has just begun the relationship with God, and to have that kind of call, and that's pretty specific as well. It's not like, you know, you should love people or, you know, maybe go to church more frequently or something. It's quite specific. So was there like an angel? Did you have a burning bush moment, some sort of dream? How did you find some clarity in that specific call?
It was a surprise to me as well. I expected God to speak to me about my own brokenness or something like that, but he didn't. I think because I was reading the Bible and I was determined to be there until God spoke to me, and God really honors faith, and so it didn't really take very long until I began to hear the voice of God. And you know, as we read the Bible, sometimes passages leap out at us, and we really have a strong sense that it's what God is saying. And so it was like that with this passage from Isaiah 61. But as I began to meditate on that, I just began to understand in my heart what God was saying to me. And it wasn't as if anybody else in my life even virtually knew where Asia was. Nobody that I knew of had been into missions. It wasn't as if it was a normal thing for a 14-year-old to hear. So it was God putting this in my heart, impressing me that this is what he was saying to me, and about this Moses calling of leading people out of slavery. So it was rather unusual.
How long did that take for you to gain some clarity? Like, was it it doesn't sound like it was an instantaneous thing. It sounds like it was more of a process. How long was that?
Yes, it was a process, because the more I began to hear God and realize that he was real and that he was interested in my life and that he had a plan for my life, the more I began to seek him for more and just to hear him more on this. So I began to hear his voice pretty quickly, probably within the first month of actually beginning to seek him. I began to understand what he was saying to me. But I continued to seek him about this for months and months, probably at least a year. I was just listening to God and seeking him. Yeah.
So with that kind of sense of call, you started to kind of plan. And when you were about 18, you went on a short-term mission with YWAM. Mm-hmm. And you ended up in Taiwan and had a pretty significant experience.
Yes. So I joined YWAM, yes, when I was 18. And I have to say, at that stage, I was still pretty messed up. You know, I had all this this pain in my life, and joining YWAM was a good move because it's got a lot of really good teaching, and God began to heal me that way. So yes, I went into missions, and I went to Asia, of course. And one of the places I went to in Asia was Taiwan. And we were working in this red light area in Taipei City called Snake Alley, really bad red light area. And in Snake Alley, there were girls in cages along the street, younger than me. I was 18. And I desperately wanted to talk with them and get to know them and understand if they wanted to be there and how they got there and what their name was. And I wasn't allowed to. But I couldn't shake the impression that these were the captives that I was called to be setting free. And I didn't know how at that stage, but I knew that this was what I was called to.
It's pretty powerful. So you came back home, back to England, and you figured that perhaps the best way to start down that path would be to be a little bit more educated. So you began a psychological degree.
Yes.
You took your degree, did your master's, had an opportunity to do a PhD. Why did you go down that track? What did you hope to accomplish in that?
Let me just say first that I read a book about Cambodia around the time that I was in Taiwan, and the Lord began to really put it in my heart to go to Cambodia. I also was researching Cambodia and realized that there was a great deal of trauma in the nation and not really very much help. So a lot of need and not really much help. And I really wanted to go to the place that I could find that was worst of all in that sense, because I wanted my life to be able to make a difference. God had saved me and healed me, and I really wanted to go to the worst place that I could find to make a difference there. So I chose psychology because I figured that this would be a good skill that I could help girls with. And so it was a fairly long path, yes, doing my degree and my master's, and I was about to do a PhD. And by this time I was in my early 30s, and I said to God, "Is it time to go to Cambodia yet?" And the Lord spoke to me very clearly, and he said, "It is way past time to go to Cambodia."
Can you... So what was your reaction then to that? Mm. Because having listened to you share a little bit this morning, you said this morning that you'd kind of come to God saying, "Are you in line with my plan or what?" And this whole kind of sense of almost, I wouldn't say getting lost in it, but you'd kind of started down a path and yeah, that was the way you're going to go. How did you feel when God responded that clearly?
Yeah. It was a surprise, because I thought that the path I had chosen was also God's path. it was a great path, nothing wrong with it, except it wasn't actually God's plan for me. So when God said to me, "It's way past time to go," you have a choice at that point. And I had a choice to either follow what God was telling me to do, which I was already behind schedule on, or to continue on my path. My plan had been to get all these qualifications and once I had my PhD to work for the UN and to bring trafficking to an end through that route. But it wasn't God's plan for me. And so I decided that I needed to give up that plan and to actually do something about moving to Cambodia. So I did tell people what I wanted to do and what I was planning to do, and everybody I spoke to, including everybody, said it was a really bad idea and I shouldn't go to Cambodia, that I needed to stay and raise my children in England and, finish my PhD and be more sensible and work there. And so I knew what God had said to me, and I knew what he'd called me to do, and so I went on a one-way ticket, and I remember getting on the plane with my two little girls and thinking to myself, "I've lost my mind. What am I doing?" Because everybody else thought that about me too. But I kept going because I knew that I was stepping out in obedience to God, and even though sometimes there's no guarantees about what's going to happen. It's sometimes faith is a risk, but I stepped out in obedience. Mm.
So you ended up going to Singapore, had a job in Singapore that then opened a door into Cambodia. And you began, as you shared a little bit earlier, to do some work with some NGOs in the trafficking industry and observe that the whole raid and rescue model, going into a brothel, rescuing these girls, putting them in a shelter and whatnot, wasn't working. That 100% of the time they would go back to sex work because the grassroots issues weren't being solved. How long did that take you to kind of figure out? And then where was God in kind of planting the seed of Daughters of Cambodia?
Yes. So it seems like a really great idea, to that model. It was conceived by people with great hearts who wanted to make a difference in Cambodia, and they thought that they had to rescue girls by force because it was the only way. It was the only way anyone had ever thought of, because, you know, doing anything else would have been pretty dangerous. So I was working in that model and using my skills and just observing over and over and over all these girls going back to the sex industry immediately because they had no job. And I just began to feel I was wasting my time, and I didn't want to waste my time. I wanted my life to really make a difference. And so I was questioning, what is the answer? I had no idea. And then one day in 2006, very early in the morning, I woke up to pray, and the Lord spoke to me again very clearly, the same way that he spoke to me when I was 14. And he said to me, I didn't bring you to Cambodia to do what you've been doing. I brought you to Cambodia because I want you to go into the brothels yourself and lead girls who are in darkness out into my light. And he said, I want you to start a day center near the brothels to facilitate what they need to leave voluntarily. So I heard the word of the Lord. I knew it was what he wanted me to do. But it also made perfect sense to me rationally, knowing what didn't work, that this might just make a difference. It might just be the gap that was missing. Pretty dangerous, but I figured it might work.
So what is it that, I mean, we can probably figure it out, but what is it that makes going into the brothels and bringing girls out voluntarily so much more dangerous than going in with a police force and taking them out by force?
I guess you have no protection. So when I started doing it, which I'll tell you about in a minute more thoroughly, it was just me and a couple of Cambodians going into the brothels, and it's much less threatening, of course. So they don't really feel threatened if it's just you on your own with no bodyguards going in. Talking with girls, I would go in and just build relationships and take programs into the brothels and build bridges, even with the brothel owners. And so, because they didn't see me as a threat at that time, they didn't try to stop me, which is quite surprising.
So tell us about the first day you went in. You took some of your savings, you rented some facilities for this day center that was close to a couple of brothels, and then you actually had to do what God had called you to, which was wander into a brothel. Tell us about that experience.
Yes, I had actually told people in Cambodia, other NGOs, what I was planning to do before I started, and everybody said, don't do it, because they didn't think it was a good idea. And they were right, except that God was in it. So the first day, we prepared the center, and then we went out and did some outreach into the brothels. We just walked into these squalid, dirty brothels and sat on the floor and started talking with girls. And if you understand the situation, you cannot just walk into brothels, especially as a foreign woman. It shouldn't have happened. It should have stopped right there. But I did. I walked in, and I sat on the floor, and I started talking with girls. And I told them that I had just opened a center around the corner, and I showed them where it was on my little map, and that we were going to run some programs the next day. We were going to have a medical clinic and art therapy and jewelry making, not for business then, it was just for fun. So I was inviting them to those programs the next day. And so they all said they wanted to come. And I just thought, there's no way you'll be allowed to come. I know how it works. So anyway, I said I would turn up the next day in my car and drive them there, because Cambodians don't want to walk in the heat. So the next day I turned up, and I said, here I am, are you coming? And they all said yes, and they all piled in the back of the car. I was looking at them thinking, have I imagined this? Is this actually real? Because it just doesn't happen. It's impossible that this would have been allowed. So anyway, I drove them to the center, and we had some time to talk with them and build relationship. And while they had the programs going on, and I asked them what they wanted for their lives. Did they want to be in the sex industry? And they all said, no, we want out. And they said they needed a job in order to get out. And so even from day one, I was conceiving the model and how it would work, something that would work for them and really address their needs. And so I drove them back afterwards. And then there was a little bit of time left in the afternoon. So there was this other brothel just along from the first one. So I just knew that God was with me. So I walked into that brothel and I said, hi, I got this center just around the corner, and right now we've got some programs going on. Do you want to come? And they all said yes. Seven of them also piled in the back of the car. And I just could not believe it. At that moment, the brothel owner turned up. And she said, oi, 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 where are you going with my girls? And I said, look, I'm just taking them to this center around the corner, and I'll bring them back after. And she said, you promise? I said, I promise. So it was impossible that actually she would have let me take them, but she let me. So we had the same programs, and I began to talk with those girls, hearing the same things about the fact they wanted out and they needed jobs. And so this is how it started. Right from day one, it was just a series of miracles. And we went on this way for about 6 months. The brothel owners knew me. They knew where I was. They could easily have come and targeted us very easily, but they didn't. And after about 6 months of trying to get them jobs, I really didn't have any business skills or knowledge, and I didn't want to reinvent the wheel if we could partner with someone else who would give them jobs. So I tried that. I tried to get them jobs with other businesses, and nobody would employ them, and nobody would accept them on vocational training courses because they didn't have any literacy or numeracy, and they looked like sex workers, and they didn't have nice manners. So 6 months in, I started our first business, which was the sewing room, and we went from there.
It's a fairly remarkable story, isn't it? And there's so much more that we could talk about. There's a few things I'll come back to a little bit later on, but we do want to give you an opportunity to ask Ruth some questions. So the number is on the screen behind me soon. Then you can text those questions that you have to Mark, we'll kind of take some time to just interact with that, whether it's about Ruth's story itself or whether it's about the wider kind of aspect of trafficking. Let me start with one question. You've been in Cambodia for 14 years. You've been actively involved, obviously. It's been 750 women who Daughters of Cambodia have helped come to a sustainable kind of out of the sex traffic lifestyle. Is it getting any better in Cambodia? Is the sex traffic industry changing? Is the work of Daughters and the work of all these other NGOs, is it making a difference? Mm.
I'd say the sex industry is growing as Cambodia is becoming more developed. It's definitely growing. There's a lot more wealth in Cambodia, and the mindset of most of the people hasn't changed, and so it's growing. What I have seen in terms of changes is that there aren't so many children, young children, being sold in the sex industry. They're older now. It's not really taking place in squalid, dirty brothels anymore. It's more glamorous entertainment centers. That doesn't make it any safer for the girls, though. But it just looks a little bit different now. So our main way of doing outreach now is not me walking into these places, but the girls through word of mouth, inviting their peers and their friends to come and join us as well. So that's actually better. It's the best way of all.
Yeah.
I have no questions yet, but I've got a question myself, so I'm going to abuse the opportunity. What keeps you going, and what kept you going in the face of kind of a bunch of NGOs saying, no, don't do this? What sustained you in pursuing what you felt God was calling you to?
Yes. Well, if you remember in my story, going back to when I was 14, I was desperate for God, and my life up until then had had no hope. And so I met God, and God healed me and saved me. And so I guess in my foundational approach to life, it's to do with God, depending on God, and God being really important to me. And so when it comes to the choice of, am I going to do the sensible thing, and the thing I would probably advise also other people, or am I going to actually step out and obey God after everything he's done for me? It's a choice, and yes, I guess that's why I'm motivated to step out and to take risks that are within the boundaries of what he's told me to do, but it's a step of faith. But I have learned that God is so faithful and so dependable, and in all these years of running daughters, I should have had some trouble from brothel owners, and I've never had any trouble. Nobody's ever come after me or my girls, and so I've seen God's faithfulness. I've seen God provide in so many ways, and so it gives me confidence that God is dependable and able.
We've had lots of questions come through asking about, kind of in the area of hearing God's voice, and you know, do you have any advice for people as they're kind of, you know, beginning to listen to what it sounds like God speaking to you, and also kind of how did you know that it was God who was speaking to you?
I suppose at the age of 14, it's easier to hear God perhaps because our lives are not so cluttered as they are later on. But reading the Bible was a pretty smart move because as we read the Bible, it opens our spiritual eyes, really. And it's easier to hear God if we've been reading the Bible because our spirit is in tune. And so I think that's the key, is really getting our spirit in tune with God. And when God speaks to me, I have to wait. It's not quick. Sometimes it is, but most of the time it's not. It's me, you know, if I'm asking God for an answer about what do I do about this crisis, which happens all the time. It's a case of listening and being still in my heart and just waiting for him to speak and not being in a hurry if he's not spoken yet. Just going back and waiting some more. And with it always comes a sense of peace that I know it's from God, and I feel a conviction in my heart as well, just a knowledge that God has spoken. It's always in line with what the Bible says as well.
What is the success rate of daughters with girls exiting the sex trade permanently?
Yes. It's a good question because now I have no way of tracking it. In the early days, we tracked every girl who left, and so we would know if they were back in a sex industry or what they were doing. And so for the first 3, maybe 4 years, we had a really high success rate of 98%, and we know this because we measured. Now those days are long gone. So now we have helped 750 girls get out of the sex industry. Some of them have gone back. I would say with quite a lot of them, it's often a case of 3 steps forward and 2 steps back. The girls who have gone back to the sex industry know that the door is always open to them. So often you find they go back to the sex industry, usually not by their own choice. It's nearly always family debt. They come under pressure because their family has run up some debt and they need to pay it off. And so they go back to the sex industry, but usually we see that they come back to us. So we have still a high success rate. Some of the girls have left Daughters and gone on to really great things. We have a girl who, while she was at Daughters working with us, was studying part-time for a degree in management, graduated, and is now managing a Christian school in the community. We have another girl who was our cafe manager a long time ago, and she then wanted to start her own cafe and did. So she has a seafood cafe in a different part of Phnom Penh, and that's going really well. So we have seen some of the girls really go on to great things.
Is there a kind of a standard length of time that it takes for a woman to kind of exit fully? You know, you talk about the 3 steps forward, 2 steps back. What kind of a process is it?
We used to have a program in which I thought it would be a good idea that after 2 years of being at Daughters, they began to sort of exit and become independent. So we started that program and we set them up with their own little social enterprises in their own homes. But we found that it really wasn't working. They actually came back to us. They didn't want to be in their own homes because they felt that Daughters was a family for them and there was a lot of help for them with their own social problems, domestic problems, and also our Christian programs. And so we stopped trying to force them to leave if they didn't want to. And instead, we promoted them to positions of leadership because they make really fantastic leaders at Daughters and peer mentors for the new girls coming in. And so is there a standard length of time? Some of them leave. Some of them perhaps leave after 3 or 4 years. There's a girl who we see every day who's no longer with Daughters. She was with us for about 4 years. And then she decided she wanted her own business. And so she set up right opposite our center a little cafe of her own, just serving Khmer food for the girls who work with us. And so, it varies such a lot. Some of them want to stay forever because they feel safe and they can operate independently, like the girl who I showed earlier in the slide, who's the new client manager at Daughters. So she's very successful, you know, operating without really need for much support, and she's helping new girls. So, but she wants to stay at Daughters, and it's fine either way. We don't mind. Whatever they want to do, we'll help them.
Have you had any near-death experiences or you know, particularly challenging times, and do you still fear them?
I have. But my two near-death experiences were not in Cambodia. But I'll tell you about them because it's quite a good story. So I was in Italy, in southern Italy, in around about the year 2000, 2001, in fact, with my two little girls and a friend. And we were driving around Naples on our own. Big mistake if you've ever been to Naples. So so we went to the hotel. We were staying at Holiday Inn, and we said to them, oh, can you recommend us somewhere to eat tonight? We'll go and find somewhere to eat. So the manager said to us, yes, go to Pozzuoli, go and eat there. And Pozzuoli, so we looked on the map, this little town on the coast, so we went to Pozzuoli to eat dinner. And as we drove into Pozzuoli, it began to become clear there was something wrong with this place. For one thing, there was nobody else there. For another thing, there was only one road in and out of the town. And it was just kind of isolated, surrounded by some hills with one road in and out. So we got to this town, it was very eerie. And we went into a pizza restaurant, no one else there. And the waiter came over and I looked in his eyes and I knew immediately we were in a mafia stronghold. And I knew we were in a great deal of danger. So this man's eyes, it looked like he would sell his own grandmother without batting an eyelid. And so we ate very quickly, were very nice to him, and tried to head out. So in our little rented car driving out on this one road, they'd set spikes across the road to trap us. And it should have been impossible for us to escape. And I have to say that the only way we were able to escape was that, you might not even believe this, but the car flew over the spikes. It was a miracle. God saved us. I hadn't even started my work in Cambodia, but God had a plan for me to do this. But God saved us. The car literally just flew over the spikes, and we saw another car at the side that had been caught on the spikes. It wasn't like it was some fake setup. There was another car there. And it was terribly distressing, but I got back to the hotel, and there was this US military guy there who'd lived a long time in this area, and I told him what had happened, and he said, whoa. He said, this is what they do. He said, you were in a great deal of danger. What they would have done if you got caught on their spikes is they would have sold you and the children into the sex industry, and that would have been it. So God saved me that day, and he had a plan for my life. The other experience I had, equally wacky, was in Africa, and maybe the year before this. So I was in Africa in a game reserve, again in a little rented car. Big mistake as well. I should learn. So just driving around this game reserve, and with the two children in the back, and there had been a sandstorm the night before, and so it had covered up all the signs saying that this particular spot is sinking sand. So we drove straight into it. And there we were in the sinking sand. And so we had just seen a lion about 3 minutes before this particular thing happened. And so I knew we were in a great deal of danger. And I knew that if we got out the car, you know, that this lion or whatever else would be able to smell us. So there was nobody else around. We had no phones. This was year 2000 or whatever year it was, no mobile phones and no way of getting help. And so I just said, right, I know the God I serve. I know that he cares about us, and I believe that he's going to send us help. Even though we hadn't seen anyone the whole day, it didn't seem very likely. And so I said, what we're going to do, and I said to the girls, we're just going to worship God. Here in this danger, in this wilderness, we're in a great deal of trouble. The car is in the sand. We're going to worship God. So we worshiped God. And after about an hour, this giant SUV came along with these people in it. So we jumped in that, and they took us back to the base. And the rangers said, we got to go now and get your car, because what happens is at night, the buffaloes come along and sit on the car, and it will just be gone under the sand. So we went and got the car, and so God saved us again. I've had more adventures. Yes, God saving my life before I came to Cambodia. So
so never rent a car anywhere in the world.
Go with a tour.
With Ruth Elliott. We might cut it there. There's lots more. Ruth will be hanging around a little bit after the service. Love to chat with you, and I'm sure that you have some questions for her. There's a whole lot more. Daughters of Cambodia is expanding to Daughters of Philippines and Daughters of Indonesia, which is in early stages. And Ruth is actually writing a book that she hopes to be published near the end of this year, God willing, that will tell the story of Daughters as well. And I think that there'll probably be a few sales at Gamia Baptist Church when you're ready to do that. Would you thank Ruth for sharing with us, though? Just before I invite Russell and the team to come up and lead us in our closing song, just a reminder, there'll be an opportunity for prayer. So the prayer team will be up the front. If there's anything you want us to pray for, that'd be great. But just wanted to reflect really briefly on the partnership that we have with Daughters. It's been going for 10 years, 11 years, something like that now, and that's part of the reason why we're supporting this project. But we're also supporting this project because there's a kind of a parallel in terms of our vision. We believe, as Ruth believes, that Jesus changes lives. And while we may not see it in such radical, obvious sorts of ways as she does, we believe that it's the same God that we serve, and that's really quite significant. But it's also, I think, really important for us to recognize that there's kind of a deeper theological reason that we partner with organizations like Daughters. And that has to do fundamentally with the doctrine of creation. We believe that God has created all men and women equally. And that's a really significant thing to affirm. While inequality between men and women takes various shapes, we saw last week or heard last week with Carolyn Cousins that one of the root causes of domestic violence is a lack of respect for women. I think we can see the parallels with what's taking place in the sex trafficking industry in Cambodia and around the world. And we know that just because it might not look the same in Australia, we know that there's still a whole bunch of inequality. And it's quite important for us to reflect theologically and to recognize that we hold and affirm the value and equality of women. That men and women have been created equal in the image of God, that we share equally in the effects and impact of sin, that we have been equally saved and are saved the exact same way by faith in Jesus, that we have been given the same Spirit, therefore gifted in the same sorts of ways and invited to participate in the same mission. God invites all of us, men and women, the elderly and children, to be involved with him in restoring the world. And we know that there's so much in our world that is in need of restoration. Hearing some of these stories, we know that that's not God's plan. That is not the kingdom of heaven on earth as it is in heaven. And so while there's a long way to go, we kind of take advantage of the opportunity to participate with these sorts of groups and organizations who can affirm the same things that we affirm. That's a pretty significant thing for us to recognize. For all of the women here tonight, we have a little gift. There's, a pile of them somewhere on one of the tables at the back there. That it's not just a little gift, but just an affirmation from our leadership about the contribution value of women and the affirmation that we have of their role, not only in the church, but in the plans and purposes of God. So we encourage you to grab one of those afterwards as well. So I'm going to invite Russell and the team up. They're going to lead us in a song of worship to close. But as they do, would you join me in prayer? Lord Jesus, we do thank you for Ruth and for her story. We thank you for the very obvious ways in which you have had your hand on her life and pray that you would continue to do so. We ask your blessing on her as she returns home. We ask your blessing on daughters and pray that you would continue to change lives and transform lives. And we pray that the sex industry in Cambodia would not just change, but that it would be eliminated. And we pray that daughters and other NGOs and whatever else you're doing would be instrumental in that. So we ask your blessing on her and on ourselves this evening, for we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.
We recognize human trafficking is a complex and challenging issue for our society. And here at GBC, we will be continuing to unpack this with ongoing conversations. If you would like further information about the work that Daughters of Cambodia are doing, check out their website at www.daughtersofcambodia.org. Thanks for listening and join us again next week.